Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce and special guest, pensions and investment editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, the budget. What else? What was in it? What wasn't? The winners, the losers, the present and the future. We pick out some of the headlines, including a huge victory for This Is Money on behalf of hundreds of thousands of elderly women. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But after much speculation, the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, delivered his crucial speech outlining the state of the economy and his plans for taxation and spending as Britain recovers from the coronavirus pandemic. Now, some things we knew before, grants for businesses, a new mortgage guarantee scheme. Some we pretty much knew, extension to furlough and the stamp duty holiday, plus more help for the self-employed. And, well, plenty that we didn't know. Simon, Lee and Tanya, your immediate holistic assessment of the budget, and then we'll pick out some of the key measures. Simon, I'll come to you first.
I think it was an okay budget. I don't really know what we could expect in the sense of a good or a bad budget. As widely predicted, Rishi didn't go all guns blazing with tax rises to start trying to balance the books, the almost impossible task of balancing books that he faces. And we'll go on to the debt and the deficit and the servicing of such borrowing in a bit. There was the suggestion that there's some stealth taxes in there. I mean, he was pretty upfront about it, in all honesty. The freezing of the tax thresholds, the personal allowance, corporation taxes going up, which is pretty low in this country anyway, and it won't be that high compared to many other countries. It will be a lot higher than it was. And it's also a complete screeching U-turn on previous Tory party policy of getting the corporation tax rate down. There's some concessions there for smaller businesses, medium-sized businesses, those not making the biggest profits. We didn't get the capital gains tax hike that some feared, but I kind of thought was never going to arrive this time round. We didn't get an attack on people's pensions. We just saw the freezing of the lifetime allowance, which I think is a lifetime allowance is a bad thing anyway, and actually what's gone on with it since it was introduced should be deeply worrying in a saving, investing, pensions terms. But you know, it was always going to do that. So I think it was okay. I think there are still some holes in it. We got some more help for the self-employed, newly self-employed. We've still bizarrely got people who've earned more than £50,000 completely excluded, even if they can show their income has crashed by 75% over the past year. What Rishi's blind spot is with those people, I'm absolutely mystified, because we're not talking about limited companies, we're not talking about dividends, we're not talking about those things there. We're just talking about sole traders who've lost a ton of money because the economy has been locked down. But, you know, it was all right. I think he's doing a decent job. Did go on for a bit, though. Maybe okay. Could have been a bit shorter. Think of those movies where you think, oh, it's finished, and then there's like another half an hour.
Yeah.
That final Lord of the Rings film.
It
could have stopped about an hour before it actually stopped. I was thinking maybe the budget could have stopped about two-thirds of the way through, and we would have been done. Some interesting stuff, though. The Freeport stuff and the business investment thing, which is like the business investing version of Eat Out to Help Out, are quite interesting. But whether they turn out to be more than pie in the sky, we'll have to see.
Ba-dum-bum. Well, let's hope they don't turn out like Eat Out to Help Out, because I don't know that Rishi was a big fan of that afterwards. Lee, your view, Simon assessment, okay, but a bit Lord of the Ringsy.
I've got similar views, Georgie. Towards the end, I was starting to lose it. The last sort of third of the budget, I was starting to really, I don't know if it was just a sugar crash from the Greggs that I got delivered to my door was wearing thin or what it was. But I would say it was quite a business heavy budget. You know, usually we're used to a few more sort of personal finance measures coming out, but I think Rishi Sunak, in the fact that he's done what is essentially three budgets in less, you know, under a year, you know, he seems to be pretty switched on, pretty clued up about all this stuff. This pandemic bill now is over £400 billion, and although there's been some measures in this budget announced that will potentially chip away a little bit at this, I still fear that later in the month there's going to be more of a sting in the tail with this tax day that's going to be having some measures in it in a couple of weeks' time. So we might be changing our tune at that point, I guess. But same as Simon, really. I think it was a perfectly fine budget. There were some holes in it, but he's doing an okay job in what is an incredibly difficult scenario. And it's very hard to judge without this scenario ever having played out before and knowing what a different chancellor, a different government might have done in a pandemic.
Although if you listen to Keir Starmer afterwards, you know exactly what should be done, don't we? Mr. Brand, Rishi looking still pretty good? Because pennies, I suppose, are still being handed out as well.
Well, I actually have to really agree with Keir Starmer when he stood up and started talking about the glossy videos and PR that Rishi Sunak has done in the run-up to this, the social media videos and all of that kind of stuff. It is a little bit overkill. And also, I'm not a big fan of pretty much everything being leaked being sent out by the Treasury before the budget's even sort of been undertaken. And then there was a sort of like weird moves like announcing that contactless payments could rise to £100 just sort of sent out by the Treasury in the morning of the budget. You know, just little things like that, just a little bit, you know, back not that long ago, all of the cards would have been sort of close to the chest, and you would have sort of found it out as you were sort of listening to the budget and digesting it. Mm. But so much of it now, it just gets, you know, sent out. And I think the Speaker pulled the Chancellor up on it as well in Prime Minister's questions before the budget. So not a huge fan of all that. But Brad Rishi, I think, is still going strong. I don't think it's as strong as when he announced Eat Out to Help Out and there's a picture of him holding plates in Wagamama kind of level, and maybe some of the popularity is wearing out a little bit. But I was looking at some YouGov figures earlier, and he's the most popular Conservative politician by quite a far margin, according to that. And snap polling suggested that 46% of people approved of the budget and were seen as the fairest in the last decade. That was some snap polling from YouGov. So, you know, more than half of people are saying he's doing well as Chancellor, 16% saying he's doing a bad job. They are pretty good figures, I would argue.
Mm. Yeah, in terms of popularity, I wonder if everything's a little bit relative. I was going to ask you, Lee, if the Greggs delivery was a nod to the George Osborne to pay pasty taxes and all that sort of thing. We got nothing like that, sort of rabbits out the hat. In terms of leakages, it's something that seems to have been, sadly, something that we've got throughout this year, I fear.
Yeah, let's go back to the days where nothing was leaked and nothing was out there, and we just found it all out in one big blob in a half an hour to hour.
I believe we journalists advocating that, because we love a bit of gossip about things beforehand. Tanya, from an investments and pensions perspective, we'll get onto the big win in a short while, but just generally an overview, how did it look in terms of from your area, from your perspective?
Well, the pension lifetime allowance is, like Simon said, a bit of a creeping worry, even though it was expected, and probably most people will say, well, fair enough under the circumstances. But it is going to fall on the people who are saving hard for retirement now. And OK, they will be the better of earners. I mean, not many people will end up with a pension pot of over £1 million. Relatively, there'll be a small proportion of the population, but they are the strivers and the people who are working hard and doing well. And I think that there's a concern that there's going to be a behavioural effect, that people who are approaching it and may even never reach it will start making potentially sort of taking damaging action, like stopping saving into their pension, missing out on employer contributions and so on, just to try and not reach it. Whereas in fact, actually, you are allowed to go over it. It's not illegal to go over the pensions lifetime allowance. It's just that you do get clobbered with tax charges afterwards. And there's actually an argument for bearing that and carrying on.
Right, well, you've teed us up beautifully, the three of you, for what's coming up, and we'll delve into those in more detail. But before we do, I wanted to start with some good news from Wednesday. Good and bad, it always is, isn't it? But a big victory for This Is Money, notably Tanya Jeffries and Pensions Agony Uncle Steve Webb. Now, after tirelessly campaigning on behalf of hundreds of thousands of women underpaid their state pension, it now looks like they'll get their money at last. That's the good news. I guess the bad news, Tanya, is that figure of £3 billion. Great that on average, I think they'll get around about £13,500, but that's £13,500 that people really needed and could have done with before. Just remind us, firstly, congratulations on the hard work that you've put in. As it was said on a radio station today, Superwoman and Superman to Steve Webb as well. Just take us back and remind us of this situation, if you would.
Yes, well, it affects women who are basically 70s and upwards now. When their husband reaches state pension age, if they're on less than 60% of his state pension, it can be raised to the 60% of what he's getting per week. And this became automatic from 2008 onwards, March 2008 onwards. But although some people got an automatic uplift, a lot of women have missed out on it. It just didn't happen. And now it's been discovered people have got massive holes in their state pension. We also, during the course of our investigations last year, discovered a potentially even bigger and more expensive problem for the government in terms of widows being underpaid because of the length of time they might have been widowed and underpaid for. And we had two extraordinary cases where a widow got £107,000. The DWP was refusing to give her interest until we took it up as a story, after which they decided to pay her an extra £10,000. And then another case of £115,000. And the really tragic aspect of this, and this is where the real, you know, human side of the story comes in. Both these ladies were elderly and both had dementia, and they never knew that they'd been handed over £100,000. And when you think they've both been underpaid coincidentally for 20 years, and when you think about all the things they could have done before they became ill, it's really heartbreaking to think about it. But even on in the cases where people have maybe got between, you know, £3,000 and £10,000, that is still an awful lot of money. And it's not just what you could do with it now in terms of we could splurge it all at once. I think it's a mindset. If you're only getting £60 a week in state pension and you should be on £80, I mean, that doesn't sound like a lot, but every week, you know, you might see your friends, you might go out for coffee, you might have lunch with them if you have got an extra bit of money in your pocket. And over the years, I think it's really been damaging, you know, to women's finances. Even on that low level, it's, you narrow your horizons to meet your budget. And I think that when I think about the way, about the whole story and what women have missed out on, it's that side of it. I think, you know, we can afford a short break in the UK, we can't afford to go to France, or we can afford to go to France, we can't afford to go to the US. It's a staggering sum, but on the human side, these ladies have missed out on what was rightfully theirs for so long.
What was the reasoning from the DWP? How did they reach that figure? What on earth are they going to do about it now?
It was actually the Office of Budget Responsibility that came up with that figure, but it is based on the DWP estimates. I mean, they seem to have done some scans and come up with, you know, a bunch of cases and made a series of estimates based on the cases they found about how, if they extrapolate it to all the women who they think might have been affected, which is 200,000 now, that this is likely the amount that they're going to have to pay back to people. One thing that I want to point out, though, is that they've stopped paying interest to women. This is now a correction exercise. Up until, I think it was early January, they were giving people special payments or interest payments on all the years that they've lost, the money that they've lost. But they are now going to stop doing that. And when you think about it, I feel that's morally unfair. People should get interest. They've missed out on this money through no fault of their own. It was the DWP's fault. There should be no question that they get interest.
Well, that was it. I mean, how did it manage to get to this stage? One, they said it was a junior civil servant error, and the other one was because some people just didn't apply and they needed to.
Yeah, before 2008, March 2008, you actually had to actively apply for this. Those people are not covered in this correction exercise. They still have to proactively apply to the DWP if they ever want to see any money. And they should do it as soon as possible because they only get 1 year back payment. So the sooner they do it, the better. Also, they get an increased pension going forward. If you're you know, husband reached state pension age before 17th March 2008 and you're listening to this, I would definitely check your state pension statements and see whether you've been underpaid, because it could be well worth it. In terms of how it happened, the best we can tell from what they've told us is that it's a manual task to update and upgrade women's pensions records, and some just weren't updated, and obviously a lot of them weren't updated. And in terms of how it went overlooked for so long, until we started asking questions and publishing loads of stories and making it clear that this was a really big problem, it may well be that some junior staff, not the ones that made the original mistake, but the ones that were called up by women, occasionally found a case and brought it to their superior's attention, but nobody really took any notice. There was a pattern of indifference, you know, and that's the kindest way to put it, really, on the management side. And the junior staff who may have or may not have reported it upwards, obviously never flagged it up strongly enough for it to really be taken seriously.
Shocking. And well done, Tanya. Thank you very much on behalf of all of those ladies. Simon, just a quick word. 3 billion. We hear a lot about consumer champions on publications and in the press winning back money for their readers, but this is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, yes. It all comes from that original reader question to Steve's column for This Is Money. And after that original reader question, some more came out and it was investigated, and then the pressure started to be put on and so on. But there's a lot of work that goes into Steve's column from both Steve and from Tanya as well. And there's been a lot of work that's gone into these investigations and putting pressure on the DWP and going backwards and forwards and getting the information. And it's all built up over time. And it's testament to the tenacity and the hard work of Steve and of Tanya. And also, it's one of those times when you feel proud that you can give really good journalism the time and the space that it needs to do the work that needs to be done, because sometimes it really pays off to the tune of people getting back a colossal sum of money, you know, because people have been colossally shortchanged. So it's really good, and there is a point of satisfaction there for us, obviously. And the story's been covered in loads of other places. I mean, Steve's campaigned heavily on this. He's done so much work on this. He's set up a tool for people to check out. Lots of other, you know, publications have published the story and put the pressure on as well. But it did all come from that original. It was triggered by that original This Is Money story. So, you know, it's great. But what is a real shame, though, as Tanya said, is that actually it's a story about people. It's not a story about all this money that's going to be paid back to people. It's a story about all the money that people have missed out on. And money is, you know, primarily a way of managing to do things and live a life that you'd like to live and so on. And that's never more important than for those people who rely on their state pension for their income and don't have their income coming from elsewhere. So it's quite a sad story as well.
Indeed, as I said, you know, a victory, but also sort of bittersweet in a way, as Tanya beautifully outlined. Tanya, thank you very much. But before I do let you go, just one question. You said for those people whose husband reached state pension age by 2008, afterwards it should be an automatic uplift. Is that right? Automatic. Do they have to check in case that hasn't happened?
Yes, you definitely should check. And although this correction exercise means that the government says it's now going to be proactively contacting people, they are going to still apparently deal with anybody who contacts them. It is worth going to Steve Webb's site. You can find it, if you put in LCP Married Women State Pension or LCP Widow State Pension, you should be able to find these tools very easy online. Input your details, see if it says you might have been underpaid, and then contact the DWP. The quickest way to do that is do a search for pension service contact. The contact details are there. You can input your postcode if you prefer to write and get an address if you prefer to write to them. We are hearing that there's quite long waiting times, not surprisingly, at the DWP at the moment. So it might be better to get a letter in, keep a copy, consider sending it registered. But either way, I really think it's worth being proactive about this. It may take several years for the DWP to work through the massive backlog of cases and get to you.
Brilliant, Tanya. Thank you so much. We're going to let you go now. Right. Well done to everybody involved. Now let's dig into the budget a little bit more. The big headlines Simon outlined at the top there, but in terms of tax rises, that big corporation tax increase that's coming down the tracks and the stealth income tax freeze, nothing yet to capital gains though. Hamstrung by the Conservative promise not to increase income tax, VAT or national insurance, the Chancellor found a couple of sneaky ways to increase the Treasury coffers. Lee, just explain fiscal drag and all that jazz. What's the income tax freeze? Because as the Chancellor says, no one is going to notice on their wage slips any less, are they?
The front page of the Daily Mail really summarised this on Thursday morning after the budget, where there's a picture of Rishi with his face mask on, and it says Rishi's mass tax raid, which I think is just absolutely genius banner of to describe what this was, basically. So when we're talking about fiscal drag here, it's basically a deflationary effect of progressive taxation system in a country's economy. So as wages rise, a higher proportion of income is paid in tax, right? So what we're saying here is the freezing income tax rates now for 5 years, that's quite a big old sting in the towel for people. It's going to put 2.3 million people projected into these tax brackets. And it might mean that they won't spend as much in the economy, and then there's that kind of effect. But that said, I think there's a big caveat here in the fact that there is a sort of £150 billion savings buffer that people have built up over the course of this pandemic, which gives it a bit of an unbalanced kind of way of looking at it. As in, people who are lucky enough to have tucked money away.
Some people,
but that's still a huge sum of money, Georgie, that some people have managed to put away. It kind of makes it a bit of an unbalanced, do you see what I mean? It's not the usual effects that you would see. So talking in terms of some of these tax freezes, essentially. So income tax freeze, as I mentioned there, 2.3 million workers are likely to be dragged into this now over the next 5 years, and it should raise Treasury £19 billion, which is a pretty tasty sum of money.
In terms of the figures per person, does it work out at something like, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you're on 18,000, for example, and of course we get a little uplift next year and then it freezes until 25-26 tax year, it's about an extra £660 you'd be paying equivalents. It's about 3,000, I think, if you were earning 60,000, because of course you've got the freeze to the 50,000 higher limit. Well, it would go up a little bit next year and then it will be frozen.
Exactly. There's lots of figures being banded around, Georgie, and actually the best thing to do is to take your salary and go away and figure out how this is going to hit you over the next 5 years, because you're right, the 40% tax rate will be frozen at £50,270, and then the lower rate is £12,570 basic rate of tax. And essentially it's just going to mean people are going to be taxed more. 2.3 million people is a pretty sizable amount of people that are going to be hit by this. And that's why it's been kind of billed as a kind of wealth tax for the middle classes type thing. But it's not just income tax. There was, again, talking at the start of the show about how many of these measures were already kind of leaked and out there, almost like a fishing exercise to see how the reaction would be. Another one is the pension lifetime allowance. So the limit of just over £1 million is going to be frozen, and that's going to affect a fair few amount of people. Yes, it's not everyone, and it is people that have been diligently saving in their private pension pot for potentially the last few decades that might be coming up to retirement. It might be younger people who have started saving into the pensions way earlier because that's the right thing to do and that's what they've been told to do, and they might find themselves, you know, kind of hit like this along the line in the future. But again, it's a move that will make another £150 million for the Treasury by the end of 5 years' time. And then we've got freezes and limits of capital gains and inheritance tax, again, which could drag more people in and make the Treasury more money. I mean, that's another £500 million that they've kind of managed to get from somewhere. But again, £500 million, when you compare that to what the pandemic bill is, it's a drop in the ocean of that, isn't it? And then we've had things like fuel duty frozen and alcohol duties and all that kind of things frozen. And then the argument might have been, well, you know, could that have been where they should have been looking at instead? But it's such a fine, hard balancing act, all of this, Georgie, isn't it? It's so incredibly difficult to know and how to start paying this huge bill down and how you do it without being completely unconservative, that in, you know, tax rises and all those kind of things. And I'm kind of guessing, you know, something like corporation tax, for example, is why that is now going to start nudging higher. I mean, 19% corporation tax is an incredibly low amount when you compare it to other G7 nations, and ticking that up to 25% over the coming years is kind of one of those moves that actually that is quite a big dent into potentially into the bill of the pandemic. But then the other argument on that is, should there have been this muted, you know, online tax, for example, for the big giants that have benefited massively from the pandemic? And I think you can guess which company in particular that I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Those terms. You know, should there be more of those kind of things being looked at? Why isn't something like that?
Well, I think, Lee, you said it earlier, but that we do have the tax day coming up in a couple of weeks, this time when I imagine that some of the bigger issues that we didn't see in this budget, you know, we heard a lot about capital gains being altered. We heard about this online tax that you've just mentioned there, perhaps something to do with business rates. We got an extension, but no real changes there. You know, would we get sort of a property levy, a wealth tax, all these ideas, the big ideas, it seems to be those were off the table. And some of the measures that you've outlined only seem to be raising enough for some of the help measures, and we'll get onto that in a while, that are going to be extended by quite some way. But Simon Lee spoke there about not very Tory. And appreciate the Chancellor was at pains to say that even at 25%, it was still below G7 countries, et cetera, et cetera. It did, though, seem to me when I was listening to the speech that it was a very political budget. And I don't mean a conservatively political. Actually, it wasn't a conservatively political. But some of the measures that Lee's mentioned there, you know, inheritance tax, pension lifetime allowance, corporation tax to 25% for the most profitable, the biggest companies, helping out the smaller ones, they will probably still have to pay 19%. It does seem to play quite well with the general public. There's no increase of income tax unless you get your head around the fiscal drag and the freeze. Then it actually doesn't seem to be too bad. Is that fair?
It's fair enough, yeah. I mean, one way to get your head around the concept of fiscal drag is there was a tweet by Paul Johnson from the IFS yesterday, where he said in 1990, 1 in 15 taxpayers paid higher rate income tax. By 2025, it will be 1 in 6. So there you go. That gets your head around the sheer volume of people who now pay higher rate tax compared to who used to. And there's another element of fiscal drag that goes on here, because at that £50,000 level, for families with children who would get child benefit, that's when they start to get it removed, and that represents effectively an extra tax on them, and that gets taken away between £50,000 and £60,000. But that level's never changed since that was brought in by George Osborne. There's another tax level, which is possibly the most egregious part of the tax system, which is that actually Britain's highest rate of tax is not 40%, it's 60%. Because people earning over £100,000 have their personal allowance taken off them at a rate of £1 for every £2 they earn, or 50p for every pound they earn, however you want to phrase it. And that means that they effectively pay 60% tax. After you get to £123,000, when your personal allowance has therefore vanished, your marginal rate of tax, i.e. the rate of tax you pay on the next pound you earn, then drops back to 40% before it then goes up to 45% later on. Again, that £100,000 has never been raised since it was brought in. So that 60% tax level, call it what it is, it's a 60% tax, is hitting people at the exact same point. So there's fiscal drag going on there as well. And it's very difficult to get people to feel sorry for people who earn £100,000 a year. But is it right that someone...
Well, that's it.
But is it right that someone earning £105,000 pays a much higher tax rate than someone earning 150 or 200 or 250 or 1 million or 2 million or 3 million? Because there's a chunk of people in this country who do earn in the millions, and they pay a lower rate of tax on the next pound that they earn than those people do. So, yeah, it goes to show. Was it an un-Tory budget, raising corporation tax?
In terms of the corporation tax, the 25%, there was a lot of articles in the sort of right wing, do I say right of wing press, that were not very happy with that. But we did also get the investment version of Eat Out to Help Out. So in 2 years' time, we get the raising corporation tax. In 2 years' time, we get the end of the super deduction. How will the two balance out? In terms of business, Simon, what, you know, from a business perspective, how is this budget looking?
From a business perspective, it looks okay. An awful lot has been done to support businesses through the coronavirus crisis. Furlough, obviously, taking a lot of their staff's wages off their hands, and also a lot of the problem of what they do, whether they make those people redundant or not. We've seen a lot of loan schemes. We've seen a lot of money dished out, ranging from like at the smallest level, but the bounce back loans to the coronavirus business interruption loans, which big companies can get. We have seen some help for the self-employed. As I said at the start of this podcast, we've also seen some people bizarrely excluded from that. The bill is now coming. Rishi has said corporation tax is going up to 25%. He has excluded smaller businesses from that using a profit measure. I don't know. I mean, corporation tax is, it's a tricky one because there's a lot of things that you can, there's a lot of ways that you can lower your corporation tax bill, basically, as a company. So, but ultimately, corporation tax, you say it's paid by companies, but it's really paid by customers of those companies, because the companies, they get their money from somewhere. So it hits normal people in the pocket. People think of corporation tax as being something that's okay. That's the tax that companies pay. It's like, well, as their customers, we are ultimately paying for that. It's a drop in the ocean, though, when you look at it. And that is the problem. And ultimately, our debt pile in the UK now stands at 2.1 trillion. The deficit will reach 355 billion for this fiscal year. That's a peacetime record. Next year, it's forecast to be 234 billion. Now, this is kind of okay at the moment, if you can judge it to be kind of okay, because our interest payments are so low, because interest rates are on the floor, government bond yields are on the floor. According to budget documents, our interest bill is going to be 24.8 billion in 2021 to 2022, rising to 33.7 billion in 2025 to 26. We're paying £2 billion a month to service the national debt, right? But that's manageable. It's large, but it's manageable given these low borrowing rates. The concern is that inflation comes back harder and faster and stickier than people think it will, and that the Bank of England is forced to raise interest rates. Or even if the Bank of England isn't forced to raise interest rates, the aforementioned inflation problem rolls around and people think the Bank of England's going to have to raise interest rates and put them higher, not very high, they'll still be very, very low by historic standards, but higher than we think they're going to be, because that's going to drive up the yield on UK government bonds, because investors are going to want to be paid more money in order to buy UK government debt. There is also, of course, the nuclear option where, you know, bond investors wake up to the whole low yield thing and just go, no, we're not having any more of this. And we don't want your bonds that pay us pitiful rates of interest, or in some countries, negative interest. But I mean, that's probably, hasn't happened yet. Who knows whether it will happen. But there is this concern that even a small rise in the expectation for interest rates, or where interest rates are, government bond yields, will suddenly mean that making those payments is much, much harder for us. Now, this is less of an issue if you're the UK than it is for some other countries, because we happen to be in total control of our own currency and we can print money. So we can just print money to pay the debts. And there has been a bit of money printing and unlimited overdraft for the government stuff going on with the Bank of England in recent times. And at the moment, everybody's looking actually at US Treasury yields and the US bond market, where yields are still, again, spectacularly low by historic standards, but they've doubled in a relatively short period of time. Doubled to a low number, but they've doubled, and that's causing a bit of a wobble in the bond market. The talk of bond vigilantes again. These bond vigilantes wandering around. You think Rishi looks dangerous in his mask? Just wait till a bond vigilante comes around. And we've seen some of the growth stocks in the US sell off. You know, it's totally bizarre to think that of a correlation between, you know, Elon Musk's punt at, you know, not even his punt at Mars, but, you know, his electric car battery future taking over the world, Henry Ford come Bond villain escapades, and the fact that the US government has to pay a little bit more to borrow some money over 10 years. But there is a link there. And that's why people have been dumping some of these highly expensive and more speculative shares like Tesla. And it's hitting UK investors in the pocket, actually. I mean, one of the UK's biggest investment funds, Scottish Mortgage, has seen its share price drop by 25% since its peak in February. And that's real listeners to this podcast portfolios that are invested in that. So I think it's probably just a wobble. Most people are thinking this bond market thing is a wobble, that this inflation thing is a wobble. But if it does stick, and if it does, you know, really come back harder and faster and stickier, central banks are going to have a bit of a problem, because everything is predicated on interest rates staying low, money being cheap, and central banks continuing to chuck the cash around.
Yeah, it's a tough job. I think we can say that it's a tough job for the Chancellor. How do you weigh all these things up? Before we move on to some of the help schemes, though, Simon, we spoke about the super deduction just slightly, and we spoke about whether this was a Tory move, the corporation tax rise. No Singapore on Thames, perhaps, for those people that were hoping that that would be the case. But I mean, could we get that with free ports, Lee? I come to you because I just look at you and think ports. You have a life saving ring behind you as well. But you know, you have been talking about ports generally, so
it's true.
Why
yeah,
not,
it's true,
Lee?
George, free ports, it's fine. Yeah. So basically, there's going to be 8 locations around the country in which it's going to, around ports, there's a sort of different custom rules which can lower costs essentially. But it's a bit of an untried and untested thing in this country. I did read something in the local press here, though. I'm in Essex. And one of them is going to be Tilbury. And Tilbury and that surrounding area is quite a deprived area. And this local news article, how accurate it was, I don't know, but suggested it could create up to 25,000 jobs. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, areas where these are going to be located are crying out for. So it's a bit of an untested thing in this country. And it means it's essentially an area inside a country which has its own custom rules. And that can mean that it can be cheaper to do business in those areas. But one of the big sticking points of this, and one of the problems is, as we've reported in not so distant podcast past, is some of these ports are struggling at the moment because of higher import costs, which have been down to things Brexit, but also the coronavirus, and also a lack of containers, which sounds like a strange thing, but there's just containers stacking up in ports around the world. At the moment, it's all a bit of a mess. And you could argue, is this a great time to be doing something like this? But my hunch is, you know, it's worth, I would have probably trialed it with potentially fewer than 8 locations, maybe get it narrowed down to 1 or 2 and see how it works out, and test the water and see if it's something that's worth adapting elsewhere. But look, at least it's a move potentially in the right direction to create jobs and do something a little bit different now we're outside of, you know, European rules.
Thank you, Lee. Well, I want to get on to you now, as I said, some of the support measures that were extended or changed, made more generous. The good news, I suppose, 5 million people who are reportedly still on furlough at the moment, that will be extended until September. More help for the self-employed. Simon's spoken about that very briefly. Criticism, though, that it doesn't nearly go far enough. The universal credit uplift, that will continue for 6 more months and then fall off a cliff. Not so with the extension to the stamp duty holiday or business rates cuts or the VAT reduction for hospitality that was announced, all those tapering off. There was a cheer for those with low deposits, but is it premature? New grants for businesses, booze, fuel and fag duty frozen, as Lee spoke about. A green bond, more money for arts and sports. So let's just pick out some of these. Simon, you mentioned the self-employed. More help. The newly self-employed can now get some money. 600,000, apparently, the Chancellor says will help.
Yes, but still leaves a lot of people who are missing help. But it basically means that people can use their 2019-2020
tax returns, and that was one of the big problems, was that those were not relevant before. And so that pulls in some people who can get another. There's another two rounds of the SEISS grants coming. These are grants of up to £2,500 per month for the self-employed. And the final round of it has been tied to a sort of decline in your profits. So you need to show that. Still an exclusion for anybody who's earned more than £50,000 in previous years, even if they can actually show that their profits have crashed, which, as I've said numerous times on this podcast, is just a bizarre exclusion when there is no upper salary cap on furlough.
Mm-hmm. Leave furlough extended until September. Whew, that's a long time, isn't it?
It does feel like a long time now, George, doesn't it? You think about when September rolls around, how long this would have gone on for and how much it's costing every month in the billions. But it's been obviously a lifeline for people. It's where... How do we start weaning off this, though? When is that kind of tapering away of this, I guess, this scheme? And that's been a lot of a hot topic, I would say, around social media. You've got the people saying it's crazy that furlough is going to be continuing to that time. And then you've got people who are obviously on the other end of the scale of that saying, actually, the chance is right to extend this furlough scheme. So that and the universal credit uplift of £20 a month as well, again, pretty costly move. But then that comes to a knife edge later in the year. Again, how do you kind of wean people off that? You know, people have potentially, unfortunately, fallen into that universal credit, you know, required to use it because of losing jobs. It's a real fine balance, I would say, about this kind of knife edge, cliff edge type thing where you might need to be tapering and helping people slowly wean themselves off it.
The I guess the argument is he's saying that employers will have to pay a little bit more as the months go by.
Yeah, it's true that. And then you think, you know, potentially if it means that some of these jobs get saved, I think we could look back and say, actually, you know, this was a worthwhile exercise, and the ABR has actually down forecast the rising unemployment that they expected. And could some of that be attributed to the success of the furlough scheme? Potentially. Again, you would have had uproar if the furlough wasn't extended, universal credit £20 uplift wasn't extended. But then you also have people that believe in the other way. So again, it goes to show what a difficult balancing act it is.
It is interesting to point out, though, that that OBR figure, I think it's 6.5% that they think unemployment will rise to, you know, obviously devastating for those people who are unemployed. But, you know, considering some of the numbers that were bandied around a year ago, less than a year ago, you know, we were into sort of the teens, it is actually quite a substantial reduction.
It's a really substantial deduction, Georgie. Yeah, you're totally right. And as I say, I mean, I'm, you know, fingers crossed that things will start to look a bit brighter from, you know, April, especially onwards, is something I think a lot of people are sort of looking towards, you know, that mid-April. Hopefully this roadmap out of lockdown, as it's been called, which I just called a plan, but apparently roadmap is the way to call it. April, May, June, things will just start getting a bit easier, and you think there might be some more spending, you know, in the economy, could start creating jobs again, jobs that are potentially being lost. Hopefully this will all just look like one big blip when we look back in half a decade's time. But, you know, it's hard to say. I am pleased that that down forecast. I mean, paints a much rosier picture of what we were looking at before. As you say, to be in double-digit unemployment rate is a worry.
Absolutely. Simon, I can't believe we've gone as far through this podcast as we have without mentioning the stamp duty holiday in detail extension. Goodness me, the column inches and the airtime that's taken up over the last few months and weeks.
Yeah, it's Rishi's encore, isn't it? It's the one more tune. No turning on the lights yet. And in fact, actually, even when we do turn, we've got an extra hour to party. And even when we do turn on the lights, they're going to keep the music on for a bit. The stamp duty holiday, which was due to end on the 31st of March, has been extended until the 30th of June. So total stamp duty holiday until 30th of June on the first £500,000 of any property purchase price. And that means that you can save a maximum of £15,000 if you buy a house worth £500,000 or more, and you will save on a sliding scale below that because you will pay zero stamp duty as opposed to what you would have paid anyway. It gets hopefully through all the people who were worried that due to conveyancing delays, they weren't going to meet the 31st of March deadline. It creates an extremely interesting scenario for the people who've agreed to buy houses in the last month or so, since the start of the year, really, who were thinking that they probably wouldn't manage to make the deadline now, but now they're like, ooh, maybe we can make the deadline. Thus somewhat potentially kicking the can down the road of the worry about meeting the deadline. That is the problem with moving deadlines. People just go, oh, well, that's the deadline. I won't do it till the last minute. But as I said, we get to keep dancing with the lights on for a bit because there's an extra bit of stamp duty holiday up to £250,000 that will run until the end of September. And the maximum saving on that is £5,000. So it's still worth having. As someone I know pointed out, I'll take that. It's better than a kick in the teeth. It's a new bathroom. Yeah. You know,
I mean, when you put it that way, Simon, yeah, I'd rather a new bathroom than a kick in the teeth.
Which I think will also just create, you're still going to get a rush to save £5,000 as well. People are still going to be trying to desperately get stuff through. The problem with the time limited element of this, firstly, is that you just, even if you move the deadline back, as I said, you just keep getting extra deadlines and extra cohorts of people who are hoping they're going to get through. Maybe we're saying that there's been all these conveyancing problems and they're an aberration, but I think you're still going to get similar amounts of people trying to rush things through. The other problem is that it skews the market and it is inflationary and ultimately undoes what you're trying to do in part. It doesn't undo the bit where you're trying to stimulate the housing market. It undoes the bit where you're trying to make it cheaper for people to move home because house prices get driven up as people rush to try and buy before the end of the deadline. And mm-hmm. We had some average house price figures this week from the Nationwide, and they show that since the month before the announcement of the stamp duty holiday at the start of July, so the end of June, the point that you can take before then to the February report, house prices rose by a shade under £15,000. And when I say a shade under, I mean like a rounding error under £15,000, the average house price. The maximum saving you can make from the stamp duty holiday is £15,000. But you can't make that saving on the average house. You have to buy one that's more than twice as expensive as the average house to save you £15,000. False economy or not? Depends, doesn't it? It doesn't feel like a false economy if you're getting 15 extra thousand pounds in your pocket when you buy a house. But it is maybe a false economy on the cost of that house. If the cost of that house then goes back down after you've bought it, if of course it stays the same in terms of value or goes up, then it hasn't necessarily been such a false economy. I tell you what I'd like to see as the end game here, the way that we do actually say, guys, it's like 3 a.m. now, okay, you really do need to go home. We are not going to keep playing any more music, but we would like you to leave. I think the free Ubers home, maybe at the end of the party, is to say, look, we're just going to keep that 0% threshold at £250,000. That's it. Like, we couldn't keep it at 500. That was too much. Let's just keep it at 250 and we'll be done with that. And we'll move on and we'll have another party in a few years' time.
Did the Chancellor, though, get up to the dispatch box and just say, hey, guys, bit of a change in a few months' time. The party is round at a different place in the form of a mortgage guarantee scheme.
The mortgage guarantee scheme does look suspiciously like Rishi Sunak has said, look, guys, come on, party's over, music's off, everybody's got to leave. But hey, after party at my house. It's going to help people get mortgages with a 5% deposit. That's something that completely dried up in the wake of the coronavirus crash. Up until then, there was decent availability of them, but banks and building societies quickly pulled up the drawbridge and abandoned risky lending. And 5% deposit mortgage lending is risky because if house prices fall, it wipes out the equity of people with the mortgages and they can find themselves in negative equity very quickly. Also, the banks and building societies were concerned about people not being able to repay, people defaulting, people missing payments. due to job losses, wage falls, people being forced into lower paid work or not as much work as they had. And so they targeted lending at the safer end of the market. Now, the problem is, of course, is that we just keep bunging more and more money at the housing market. The real problem we have is that houses are too expensive, property is too expensive in this country. And we keep trying to bridge the gap with various schemes. This looks suspiciously like the non-new build part of Help to Buy. There's nothing necessarily wrong with the 95% mortgage. If you're renting, you could very well find yourself in the position whereby actually put down a 5% deposit on a house, buy it with a 95% deposit mortgage, and you're actually paying a couple of hundred pounds less on your mortgage than you were in rent. So it might feel like a no-brainer. But we just seem to be completely unwilling, really, to let the market deal with the fact that property is too expensive in this country, and it has never got back to the long-term average after the financial crisis. And the only reason why people can continue to afford homes at the level that they're at, and house prices, bear in mind, have gone up again over the past year, is due to very, very cheap mortgage rates and the subsidies that we keep bunging people. And we're bumping up against that limit whereby banks and building societies are struggling to actually lend people the money that they need, because it's not just the deposit. It's the multiple, it's the affordability, it's the multiple to their salary. And we saw before the coronavirus crash, there was some things going on around the edges. The 25-year terms had become 30-year terms, had become 40-year terms. There was hints of interest only coming back in. At the margins still, but I did wonder whether the banks and building societies were going to quietly usher that one back in. And you do reach a point where people just can't keep continuing to afford paying for properties that are so expensive. And I think we're very near that point. I think Rishi's just trying to bridge the gap, though, until the banks and building societies step back into the 95% mortgage market. But I mean, people should bear in mind that house prices are still, even by the Office of Budget Responsibility, forecast to fall. Only slightly, but they are still forecast to fall. The thing is, though, with a 95% mortgage, if you find that house prices go in your favor, even if they don't go in your favor, even if they just stay stable, after 5 years, and they're trying to push people to fix for 5 years of these mortgages, you will have paid off enough that you should be down below the 10% deposit level, and that would be good news.
So, in sum, then, because I'm very conscious of time, that we don't end up being Lord of the Rings Part 3 and just go on and on and on, because there's plenty more that we could talk about, and I'm sure in due course we will talk about all of these things again, probably multiple times. But in sum, do you think that this budget will do what Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, presumably hopes that it will do?
I think what the Chancellor's been trying to do here is not bring in big tax rises now, not present us with the bill for balancing the books, or how we even start to think about balancing the books. They're so unbalanced. He's got some tax rises coming in down the line, but the largesse is still there. And he's hoping that we achieve escape velocity to get a real recovery going. Once more people are vaccinated, lockdown is eased, hopefully we don't go into another one, the economy picks up, there's enough people whose incomes have remained stable, who've saved money. Some people, you know, their household incomes have fallen substantially, but others, they haven't, and they've saved money. And if those people can get that out there and go spending, we've got this pent-up demand. We've seen it. We saw it last year in the summer. Then maybe we can get escape velocity and we can get back to normal. But I think you need to remember that the old normal wasn't even that great. The economy was sluggish. It had its problems. We've just seen an election fought on the whole idea of levelling up due to the huge geographical imbalance in the UK economy. And maybe actually, my glass is half full. I think that perhaps we can get escape velocity, that we are going to see a bit of a consumer boom off the back of this, but we're also going to see some substantial productivity gains. There's this talk of 5 years in 1 year, some of the digital adaptation, technological transformation, even the working from home stuff. You can now tap into people working, if they are able to work from home virtually, from any part of the country. It's much more acceptable. I think there are people who suggest we're going to see big productivity gains. I interviewed Nick Train for the Investing Show about a month ago, and he was arguing that we're going to see that, and not just in the UK, but around the world, and that could lead into a good few years. I think that we will, you know, maybe see a good 3 to 5 years. My concern is, though, that we are going to get some kind of reckoning for all of the debt that we've built up. I'm just hoping that we don't get that reckoning immediately after COVID, and that we get at least a nice period in the middle before it comes.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate in read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.